Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 21st of May, these are our main stories. All government ministers representing a far-right party in Austria have resigned as the fallout from a corruption scandal grows. A French court has ordered doctors to resume life support for a quadriplegic man whose case has become central to the right to die debate. President Trump has directed one of his former legal advisers, Don McGahn, not to appear before a congressional committee to testify about the Mueller report. Also in this podcast...
We know that there are lots of stress factors on bee populations at the moment. Agriculture is probably the main driver. The use of pesticides, we know, has a very damaging effect on bees.
On World Bee Day, the Worldwide Fund for Nature expresses concern about the disappearance of many of the species in parts of England, with others on the brink of extinction. All ministers in Austria belonging to the far-right Freedom Party have resigned, throwing the government into chaos. The party said the move was a response to the call by the Conservative Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, to sack the country's interior minister. Mr. Kurz said the minister, Herbert Kickl, should take responsibility for a rapidly developing corruption scandal. The row centres on a video showing the disgraced Freedom Party leader, Heinz Christian Strache, offering a supposed Russian oligarch's niece government contracts in return for party funds. I got the latest from the BBC's Bethany Bell in Vienna.
Austria's Chancellor Sebastian Kurz had said today that he could no longer work with the far-right Interior Minister Herbert Kickl. He said that Mr. Kickl was unfit to carry out the investigation into the disgraced Freedom Party leader, Heinz Christian Strache, who had to resign because of this video. And he said that the Mr. Kickl should really be fired. The Freedom Party responded saying, OK, no, if Mr. Kickl goes, we all go. So basically, half of the government, all of the Freedom Party ministers, say they're walking out.
So what happens now? What's the Chancellor doing now?
Well, it has to see quite what they'll do with the government. The Chancellor has suggested that all of the ministers who've walked out could be replaced by technocrats, by experts, until elections are held in September. That may not be that easy, though, because Mr. Kurz could now face a vote of no confidence in Parliament, and because a small party has filed a no-confidence motion in him. Now, if the big parties, including the Freedom Party and including the opposition Social Democrats, decide that they also are going to have a vote in that vote of no-confidence against Mr. Kurz, then the government's in a real pickle. There is no confidence in the government anymore. And it's up to the president now, the head of state, to try and figure out what should happen next.
Bethany Bell in Austria. It is a case that's been making the headlines in France. On Monday, doctors started switching off the life support for a man who's been in a persistent vegetative state since 2008. But just hours later, a court ordered it to be turned on again. Vincent Lambert was in a road accident 11 years ago, suffering devastating injuries. Euthanasia is illegal in France, but doctors may stop feeding a patient if there's no hope of recovery. Vincent's parents have been fighting to try to keep him alive. Earlier, his mother, Viviane, accused Vincent's doctor of informing her by email that his life support would be ended.
We're gradually switching him off, little by little, little by little. They're Nazis, that's what I think. I won't tell you what I think they deserve. It's shameful. Yesterday, we spent the whole afternoon with our son. They just coldly informed us. By email.
Well, I got the latest from our reporter in Paris, David Chazan.
This is an astonishing and completely unexpected development, because it had been understood that Vincent Lambert's parents had exhausted all the legal avenues in their prolonged battle to maintain life support for him. They'd been through a number of French courts and the European Court of Human Rights, and only a week or two ago, France's highest court rejected their appeal. But now, only hours after doctors began shutting down life support, a Paris appeals court has issued an 11th hour ruling that it must be resumed. And it's ordering the French authorities to follow a recommendation by a United Nations Committee on the Rights of Disabled People that the case should be further considered before the 42-year-old quadriplegic is allowed to die. So this was really a day of high drama, with even the Pope stepping in and saying that life should always be safeguarded and we should not allow what he called a throwaway culture.
Yes, I mean, this has been very divisive, not just for the family, but all across France and French society, hasn't it?
Yes, that's right. This is an issue that's pitted Mr. Lambert's wife, Rachel, against his parents, who are devout Catholics and say that turning off life support would be tantamount to murder. It's pitted the church against the medical establishment, which argues that there's just simply no point in maintaining life support because Mr. Lambert has irreversible brain damage and there is no hope of recovery. And also, the French state is now finding itself on the other side of the argument to the UN because its Committee on Disabled Rights, as I was saying, wants the matter considered further. Mr. Lambert's wife, Rachel, who is, like he himself, a psychiatric nurse, says that he would never have wanted to be kept alive in this state. Yeah. And on Monday morning, as doctors were turning off life support, she said that allowing him to die would be like letting him go free.
David Chazan in Paris. President Trump has formally blocked a demand from Democrats in the US Congress to hear testimony from the former White House counsel, Don McGahn. Mr. McGahn had been due to appear on Tuesday to be questioned about the Mueller investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Gary O'Donoghue has this report.
Citing a legal opinion from the Department of Justice, the White House says that 50 years of bipartisan precedent means Mr. McGahn is not legally required to appear to answer questions about his official responsibilities when he was doing the job. And in case he thought that left the decision up to him, the statement from the press secretary says he's been directed not to go. That could leave Mr. McGahn open to a vote of contempt by the House and is likely to lead to court battles in which Democrats will seek to enforce their subpoena.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. The World Food Programme says it may have to suspend aid deliveries to people in desperate need in areas of Yemen, where Houthi rebels are obstructing the agency's work. Lise Doucette has the details.
Yemen is facing what's called the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and most of the needy live in Houthi-controlled areas. Now the World Food Programme has made it clear their greatest challenge doesn't come from the guns, but from what it describes as the obstructive and uncooperative role of some Houthi leaders. In an unprecedented warning, it said aid convoys were being blocked and repeated obstacles put in the way of selecting beneficiaries. The agency didn't mince its words. This had to stop.
Lise Doucette. Palestinian officials say they won't attend a US-led conference aimed at bolstering the economies of the occupied West Bank and Gaza. Washington said the gathering in Bahrain next month would focus on economic aspects of its long-awaited Israeli-Palestinian peace plan. But the Palestinians say they won't participate. They've boycotted President Trump's administration since he recognised the disputed city of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Against this background, in April, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, promised to annex parts of the occupied West Bank. And there's also widespread speculation that next month, President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, may at last unveil his so-called deal of the century, charting a new way forward for the Israelis and Palestinians. So how's all this playing in Israel and the occupied territories? In a special report, here's Tim Franks.
Sometimes as you try to work out the situation in the West Bank, it can seem phenomenally complex and detailed the jigsaw there is of Israeli settlements and Palestinian communities, of different areas of control, of different levels of access and restrictions. But sometimes the picture that confronts you is very stark and very clear, and in this case, pretty noisy. It's Friday, it's just gone noon, it's Ramadan, and this is one of the main checkpoints in Bethlehem. It's rammed with men who are trying to get through to Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, very short distance away, in order to pray. How long have you been waiting? Good grief. So you've been waiting 7.5 hours.
This is, denying people right to get into Jerusalem, whether they are Muslim or Christian, is racist. It's discrimination.
For the last 25 years, you've had the Palestinian Authority. What's changed for you?
The situation is becoming more and more worse. It's going backwards instead of forwards. Before the Palestinian Authority, we used to have the freedom of movement, we used to work. So the situation is only getting worse after the BA. You are ruling me while me and you are under occupation.
It's a common view among Palestinians anyway, as long as I've been coming here, that things are getting worse. Further north from Bethlehem, for the people in this part of the West Bank, the outlook is rosier. This is the Israeli settlement of Kfar Dumim. Ariel Dad has lived here for nearly 40 years. His terrace, I'm told, has one of the most commanding views of the West Bank you'll ever see.
It goes all the way from near Jerusalem down to Jericho. If it would be a clear day, we could see Amman, the two towers at the west side of Amman, just on the horizon.
Ariel Dad is a former member of the Knesset. He's retired now and has long been one of the most forthright advocates of a simple solution to the problem of land in the West Bank. Israel should annex it all. Towards the end of last month's election campaign, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he didn't go quite that far, but he did throw out a promise formally to extend Israeli sovereignty to settlements in the West Bank. Ariel Dad, the old politician, is not punching the air just yet.
Netanyahu, he never suffered from an overdose of ideology. But his ideology wouldn't drive him to annex Judea and Samaria. More and more voices are calling for Israel sovereignty on Judea and Samaria, and he will not. He will say so again and again. Nothing at the end. He's not the guy to annex anything.
But maybe when this long-awaited peace plan from Jared Kushner comes out, that plan will be to bury once and for all the idea of a Palestinian state. Do you not see the direction of travel in the way that you would like it to be?
Yes, certainly. Sometimes it seems that Trump is right to Netanyahu on several issues. I don't remember easier international political climate for us. They are looking for Plan B. They are looking for an alternative.
Ariel Dad on what he says is now the American-led hunt for Plan B. But another old hand sees it differently. Shabtai Shavit is the former director of the Mossad, Israel's spy agency. In his Charles Eames armchair, tumbler of Scotch whiskey in hand, Shabtai Shavit says that, after all, Donald Trump has given Benjamin Netanyahu, now could be payback.
From what I hear and what I read, I conclude that Trump is going to pressure us to make concessions. He's in a good position to do it. He tells Bibi, listen, I moved my embassy to Jerusalem. You owe me.
One of the things that Jared Kushner has said is that, in a sense, we need to stop obsessing about two states. So that what he's talked about is security for the Israelis, economic prospects for the Palestinians. But do you think removing the idea of a formal Palestinian state is possible? I mean, is it just imaginative thinking or is it fantasy?
It's fantasy. With all the respect that I have to Jared Kushner and to Greenblatt, when it comes to the Middle East, they are rookies, both of them.
So what could be the Palestinian response to all this? Here at the Yasser Arafat Museum in Ramallah, you can hear, well, not just the former Palestinian leader's words, but the whole narrative that the current Palestinian leadership want to tell, spinning a story of a charismatic figurehead, of mass support, of heroic setbacks, of loyalty to a struggle in the forging of a nation. But the picture beyond these polished, quiet corridors is different. We've heard it through those voices in Bethlehem at the start of the report, expressing frustration and disillusion, and with the Israeli and American governments uniting to put the squeeze on that leadership. Ahmed Majdalawi is the Palestinian Minister for Social Development here in Ramallah. Aren't he and his colleagues just running out of space and leverage?
No, because the Palestinian leadership until now have a veto.
So you're rejecting this deal before you even know what's in it?
No, look, you can see what the American implement until now. Jerusalem, as a capital for Israel, started this deal. The United States started to implement his deal before submit his document. If the Palestinian leadership said no, there is no Arab country, one Arab country. He will be partner in this deal. And after that, you see the position of the international community.
Defiance from the Palestinian minister. No one here, how many times over the years have I said this, but no one here is predicting a quick breakthrough. Some are even doubting whether President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, will ever present his plan.
That report by Tim Franks. Now, news of another podcast from the BBC World Service. You might be interested in this. It's called Outlook, and every episode brings you a new story of ordinary human beings in extraordinary situations. Recently, we've heard from a woman who can't make long-term memories, the father of a murder victim who became friends with the killer's family, and the man who became an internet sensation when he rescued two dogs from a frozen lake. That's the Outlook podcast from the BBC World Service. Just search for Outlook, wherever you found this podcast. A court in Portugal has found eight police officers guilty of kidnapping and beating up six youths from a predominantly black neighbourhood on the outskirts of Lisbon. Only one officer received a prison sentence. The others were given suspended sentences for various crimes. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
It's an outcome that's likely to please no one. Eight of the 17 officers on trial were found guilty of offences including assault, kidnapping and falsifying statements to play down what they'd done. Their lawyers say they will appeal. But charges of racism were dropped. It dates back to a noonday incident in February 2015 in Cova da Moura, a drug-ridden shantytown. Police pinned a black youth to a wall and opened fire with rubber buckshot at bystanders who remonstrated. The injured said officers racially abused them, but the court ruled that the claims could not be substantiated.
Mike Sanders. China's government has attempted to play down Google's suspension of cooperation with Huawei, a development that's likely to have major consequences for the Chinese telecoms firm. The decision means Huawei will lose Google's support for the Android operating system developed by the US firm and used in Huawei smartphones. Google's decision came after President Trump said last week that US firms now needed a special license to do business with Huawei. Jeremy Thompson is Executive Vice President of Huawei UK.
We have been making plans for this possible outcome. But it hasn't happened yet. We have a parallel program in place to develop an alternative. We'd rather work with Android. If it doesn't happen in the future, then we have an alternative in place which we think will delight our customers. I think in the short term, it's not good news for Huawei, but I think we can manage that.
Razia Iqbal spoke to Emily Taylor, who is an associate fellow with the International Security Department at Chatham House here in London and editor of the Journal of Cyber Policy. So how will the decision by Google actually impact Huawei?
It's a blow, no doubt about it. Google is a major world provider of software and the quality of its services and software is excellent. I think it's going to be a setback for both Huawei and for Google. But perhaps the difference between the two is that Huawei says that it's been preparing for this moment. And so it's got a contingency plan and is planning, it sounds like is planning to provide its own environment and is planning an app gallery and so on. So it's sort of going to do its own thing and be a bit more independent of Google software in the future.
So to what extent is this a decision by the Trump administration that could backfire, given that it's going to make an impact on really big American companies too?
It could quite well backfire, and this is the risk of protectionist policies in a global supply chain. It's not just going to affect Huawei. The Huawei handset market is enormous. It's the second biggest handset provider in the world, and it shipped 200 million units last year alone. And so to bar Google products from that market, which is very big in developing markets and for lower income individuals, could affect Google as well. And we might end up in a scenario where you have a sort of East and West type of internet or any other type of divides. But it's certainly worrying news for anyone who cares about the integrity of the single global internet or even, you know, technology supply chains being immune from politics.
So one of the bigger picture elements of what you're saying is that the news today about Huawei is an indication of the Trump administration seeing the kind of confluence of both economic and national security concerns coming together.
Yes, national security concerns are very much front and centre in at least the rhetoric surrounding these decisions. But to some critics, national security is used as a sort of cloak to justify economic interests. And the backdrop to all of this is the ongoing US-China trade war.
One of the really fundamental issues in the trade talks between Washington and Beijing is intellectual property and the way in which the United States feels that it's at a disadvantage when it comes to functioning and working in China. In that context, I wonder what you make then of the Chinese continuing to say that Huawei is an independent company, that it is not part of what we understand the Chinese economy to be, which is state capitalism.
Yes, there's always been questions about Huawei's exact ownership structure and its exact relationship with the Chinese state. Its critics say you don't get to be that successful in China without having very close links to the state. Huawei and its advocates say point to a single piece of evidence, and so far, in the public domain at least, evidence of those vulnerabilities and those links is lacking. There's this saying, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. In other words, just because you haven't found the evidence doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
That was Emily Taylor, an associate fellow with the International Security Department at Chatham House. Now to Bangladesh, and thousands of fishermen in the country are planning to protest against a government ban on sea fishing. They say they'll be left without any alternative ways of making a living. Previous bans have focused on commercial trawlers, but the 65-day measure, which has just come into effect, extends to small local fishermen too. Luke Jones spoke to the BBC's Akbar Hossein in Dakar and asked him why is the government taking this measure?
This is a very major decision taken by the Bangladesh government because they think if they can put a ban on fishing on the sea, it will actually help to increase fish production in the country. because for the last one decade, Bangladesh has been struggling to increase its fish production. That's why Bangladesh government has taken this step. So they think that with this decision, if they can implement it, the fish production in Bangladesh will go up at least 20% in the next years. That's why they have taken the decision.
And how is this kind of thing going to be enforced?
This decision, it is being implemented across the country from today. And I was actually talking to one of the fishermen in Bangladesh's southern part. And he was telling me that they are actually struggling. They can't go to the sea because according to the estimate provided by the fishermen agency, they said that 65,000 fishermen are being affected by the decision. If we consider they are family members, it is actually around 300,000 people are being affected. So these people, they are completely dependent on fishing on the sea. And many fishermen, they actually earn less than $4 in a day. So you can imagine how poor they are. So they say the government has taken the decision without giving them, you know, any rehabilitation or any compensation.
That was Akbar Hussain in Bangladesh. Many species of bees have disappeared from parts of England and others are on the brink of extinction. That's according to a new report released by the Worldwide Fund for Nature and Bug Life on World Bee Day. It says some species can now no longer be found in the east of England. Richard Hamilton reports.
17 types of bees that were previously recorded in eastern counties are now no longer there. Another 25 species are threatened and a further 31 are at risk. Fanny Calder, who's the campaigns director at WWF, says pesticides, pollution and intensive farming methods are among the culprits.
We know that there are lots of stress factors on bee populations at the moment. Agriculture is probably the main driver. The use of pesticides, we know, has a very damaging effect on bees. But also their habitats are being really cut up and it's very hard for bees to move around. It's very hard for them to find the flowers that they need. And climate change is adding to all of those stresses. On top of everything, it's getting hot. And when they need to migrate to north to get away from the increased temperatures, they're finding there's nowhere to go because the habitat isn't there for them.
She says the plight of bees in Britain is symptomatic of a bigger picture in which the planet's natural systems have come under severe stress. Earlier this month, the United Nations released a report on biodiversity saying 1 million species are at risk of extinction. And a previous WWF study concluded the world had lost 60% of its wildlife since 1970. It's recommending a number of measures, including what it calls wildlife corridors, to allow bees and other pollinators, such as butterflies, to spread around the country.
That was Richard Hamilton. Now, listen to this. Believe it or not, those are the sounds of a working model railway. Enthusiasts around the world spend hours and hours working on building the miniature trains or painting the match-sized signalmen. Now, one model railway club in Lincolnshire in eastern England is recovering after its priceless collection was destroyed by vandals. The organisation says it has been overwhelmed by a flood of donations from around the world, including nearly $13,000 from the singer Rod Stewart. The club was forced to cancel its annual exhibition after the attack in the early hours of Saturday morning. Danny Savage reports.
When pictures were published yesterday of battered and broken model railway layouts in a school hall in Lincolnshire, it touched a nerve with enthusiasts around the world. As members of the Market Deeping Model Railway Club tried to comprehend why anyone would want to completely trash their collection, built up over decades, people started to chip in to raise £500 to help. By lunchtime today, the total pledged was more than £50,000. Peter Davis is the chairman of the Market Deeping Model Railway Club.
So many people have been so generous. They've been generous in spirit, they've been generous in action, and they've been generous in finance. And that will enable us to do things that maybe we only ever dreamed of. It was just total devastation. Layouts that had taken many years to build, one of them 25 years, were just so much matchwood.
The singer Sir Rod Stewart then pledged £10,000 to help the club. The 74-year-old said he felt their pain and revealed it had taken him 23 years to amass his model train collection. A police investigation is underway into the incident at Welland Academy in Stamford. Four youths have been arrested.
Danny Savage reporting. And the tally for the donations now? $98,000. Is that the time? Time to leave. I'm always leaving. On that midnight train. Checking out now. That's all from us. But there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.